It's 6 a.m. in Beijing, 10 p.m. in London, and 6 p.m. here in New York. I'm Julia Chatterley, and wherever you are in the world, this is your First Move. And a warm welcome once again to First Move, and here's your need to know. Gangs, militias and the police all wrestling for control of Haiti's capital. David Culver is live from Port-au-Prince. The IDF releasing new and unverified images of their current military operation in Gaza's Al-Shifa hospital. It comes as President Biden speaks to Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu for the first time in over a month. And former President Donald Trump is unable to secure a massive bond in his civil fraud case, according to his lawyers. The question is, what now? All that and more coming up. But first, to the violence engulfing Haiti's capital. Gangs continue to unleash attacks as militias and what's left of the police try to block their advance. Haitians in some of Port-au-Prince's wealthiest neighborhoods have now been targeted too, with at least 10 people killed in the chaos. The United Nations estimates around 80% of the capital is now controlled by gangs. David Culver is there, as I mentioned, and visited a police station that's under constant threat.
So police stations like this one here in Port-au-Prince are main targets for gangs. They feel like as soon as they can get hold of a station like this, they can then take siege and take control of much of the community. So, and they've tried coming after this one many of times. Reinforcements have been built up not only because of the police, but because of the community. They've built barricades all around here. For the police station to function properly, they need to rely on the community and to have these almost vigilantes building a lot of the barricades to keep out any gang members.
And David joins us now. David, I know we've seen several of these police stations attacked or burned down over the last couple of weeks, but I just want to get your experience talking to the civilians that have got caught in the crossfire here. I know you've been speaking to both the elderly and the very young who've been injured as a result of the violence that we've seen. What can you tell us?
Yeah, really, Julia, no one is shielded from this surge in violence that is taking Haiti's capital city, Port-au-Prince, really under a tight grip over the past 2 weeks in particular. And to your point, the folks who are feeling the brunt of this are everyday people who live in this city and who have now been forced to move at times from home to home to home, campsite to shelter. And we caught up with some who are now in the hospital because, as you pointed out, they end up in the midst of the crossfire. And it's interesting, having gone into one hospital that's run by Doctors Without Borders, and to talk to the patients there, it was tough to find somebody who was not in there because of a gang violent related injury. Vast majority are gunshot victims. And one of the women was an 86-year-old who we met with. She was going to the market, was out there and shot right in the leg, and ended up being local journalist who brought her to that hospital. Now what's even more tragic is she's not quite sure how she's going to get back home, or even if she has a home to go back to, or if that's been taken over by gangs. She also says her loved ones really aren't comfortable coming to visit, and that's because that hospital is located in a really precarious area. It's essentially nestled between rival gang territories, and at times police are able to take hold of it, but the vast majority of the time it becomes just a battleground. And so for even the medical staff to have to go in there every single day, it's a challenge, to the point, Julia, where they even will have some who are able to sleep on site and may not even get back to their own families. But it shows you just the level of dedication needed amidst the desperation that's playing out here, Julia.
Yeah, David, I just wonder who people actually trust to defend them in these kind of circumstances, because particularly when you're talking about the wealthier neighborhoods now being attacked, being looted. I mean, these are arguably the people that could afford to hire their own private militias and security. And that, in many ways, provides some level of protection, but it also potentially also escalates the violence. Who do people trust to take care of them in this situation?
Neighbors helping neighbors.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's, you bring up such a great point, because that played out about 3 miles from where we are. And it was in an area this morning where you have a more affluent community for sure. And yet they too were dealing with this attack and onslaught by gangs at 5 o'clock in the morning, and they were terrified. And you don't have the comfort and ability to pick up the phone and call police because police are so stretched in resources and even sometimes don't even have the fuel to get to those emergencies. So you turn to those who live next door to you, and a lot of them have created these almost self-defense brigade-like systems where some are armed, others are just manning different barricades at every entry and exit to their community, and they rely on each other so as to protect one another. And even to keep those staff 24/7, you have to think about how you get food to those individuals who are on the front line, so to speak. Well, it's the community that will create their own sort of tax collection-like system, and they'll go door to door and they'll try to get anything from a few dollars to some soda, whatever it takes to bring some sustenance to those who are actually trying to block the gangs from spreading their reach and encroaching on everyday life here in Port-au-Prince. It is an incredible struggle, and yet you also have these refugees, Julia, who have found themselves refugees within their own cities, and they've had to go to these different sites, and we even met some who were in the midst of a school that has now turned into a makeshift campsite, and you have about a dozen classrooms in that school, but more than 1,500 people who have just crammed in to make it their temporary home. And what's a struggle for them is not only do they face the gang violence being there, but they also face now confrontations from the locals who live around that area and who say, we don't want more people coming in because it'll attract more gangs to come into our area. So they're feeling it from all sides, and it becomes for them an increasingly dire situation, especially, Julia, when you consider getting food and medical supplies to those locations is an incredible challenge right now. You've got the UN trying with the air bridge. It's up and going. But as soon as it comes into Port-au-Prince, how do you get it through the gang territories, past the barricades, and to those who really need it most?
Yeah, the fractures in society are clear for everybody to see, and it's good to have you there to help tell the story. David, stay safe yourself, please. Thank you for now. David Culver there. Now, the global community is watching with growing concern at the horrifying scenes we're seeing in Haiti. World Trade Organization Director General Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala talked to me earlier today about the dire situation in the country and her hopes for a better future there.
As one of the least developed countries, we would be very sad to see the continuing conflict and chaos that seems to be taking hold in the country. And we would hope that a solution can be found so that it can return as a full-fledged trading member of the WTO. We wish the Haitians well, and we wish an end to the internal conflict that is going on there.
And there's plenty more of my conversation with the WTO Director General there, Dr. Ngozi. Later in the program, we discuss why her organization remains cautious on the outlook for global growth and trade. For now, we'll move on. Donald Trump's lawyers say they can't find an insurance company to underwrite his bond in the civil fraud judgment against him. His lawyers say 30 companies have refused to secure it. This is, just to be clear, for his $454 million judgment in New York from last month. The former president and his company have until March 25th to post the bond. Caitlin Plants joins us now. Caitlin, just to take a step back, he's appealing this ruling, of course, but he's got to hold the state at bay in the interim and stop them from enforcing it. And the way you do that is to post a bond. The problem is, I think this is an enormous sum of money, and even underwriters, I'm sure that he's going to, have financial limits.
Exactly, Julia. This is really the end of the line when you lose a lawsuit like this. Either the people who win, which in this case is the New York Attorney General's office, the state of New York, they get to come in and enforce that judgment, collect on it, seize assets, seize properties. And that judgment is $454 million at this point, plus an additional $10 million because of the findings against Donald Trump's two sons, who also have a role in his company, Donald Trump Jr. and Eric Trump. And so that $464 million, they either are going to seize that, or Donald Trump has to post a bond. That's where he's running into trouble right now. The deadline for him to do that is at the end of the month, right around March 25th, so about a week away. His team has approached 30 different underwriters for a bond, and they have all said no. One of them, an insurance broker who works with Trump, told the court that this is a practical impossibility to get a bond of this size. It's nearly a $500 million. And the way that these underwriters work is they want money backing that in cash. That is a lot of money in cash if that's what Trump would need to post for the bond. They're unable and unwilling to take real estate, which is what he has in many of his assets, instead to underwrite the bond. Or separately, some of the underwriters would have policies that wouldn't allow them to offer a bond of this size. They wouldn't go much over $100 million. So there is some time left for Trump to figure this out if he wants to keep appealing this and doesn't want to have this lawsuit judgment enforced against him by the state of New York. But he is running out of time, and this is a bit of a difficult situation now for the former president, not just in this lawsuit, but as all of his legal issues come to roost at this time.
Yeah. Underwriters want liquid assets. They want cash and they want stocks. And there's not many people that have got, what, $500 million in liquid assets like that just hanging around. We shall see. Caitlin Plants, great to have you with us. Thank you for that report there. Now, Israel sending a team to Washington to discuss the fate of Rafah and the 1 million plus civilians sheltering there, following the first phone call in more than a month between Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and U.S. President Joe Biden. Now, White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan clearly outlined the difference of opinion on this subject at Monday's press briefing.
Anytime I hear an argument that says, if you don't smash into Rafah, you can't defeat Hamas, I say that is a straw man. Our view is that there are ways for Israel to prevail in this conflict, to secure its long-term future, to end the terror threat from Gaza, and not smash into Rafah. That's what we're going to present in this integrated way when this team comes.
Now, meanwhile, Israel launched a second major military operation at the largest hospital in Gaza, claiming the Al-Shifa hospital is being used by senior Hamas terrorists. The Palestinian Health Ministry says many died there on Monday, where an estimated 30,000 people are now sheltering. Jeremy Diamond joins us now. Jeremy, there will be some viewers getting a deja vu sensation because, of course, this hospital was the one that came under fierce scrutiny back in November when the IDF went in there again under the same context, saying that they were targeting Hamas fighters. What do we know about the operation this time around? And, of course, we've got images now, too. Unverified, of course, of the operation once again there.
Yeah, that's right. Well, the Israeli military launching a very significant military operation overnight at Al-Shifa Hospital and in the surrounding Al-Rimal neighborhood. But this time it comes in the context of 30,000 civilians believed to be sheltering at that hospital. And as the Israeli military approached, using not only ground troops, but tanks, armored vehicles, and also appearing to carry out several airstrikes in the area, they say that they were carrying out an operation targeting Hamas militants who they say were sheltering at the hospital, using the hospital's grounds to carry out their operations. The Israeli military says that it killed some 20 militants, including a senior Hamas operative. And they also showed video in which they say that they found weapons and ammunition that was found on the grounds of the hospital. Hamas also said that it engaged in firefights with Israeli forces in the area around Al-Shifa Hospital. But what is also clear from eyewitnesses on the ground is that there was not only significant damage to the hospital complex itself, with the surgical building being set on fire as a result of what one doctor said was Israeli missiles hitting that building, but also airstrikes in the Al-Rimal neighborhood. We saw video with large plumes of smoke in the area in that neighborhood. There was also significant damage to buildings in that area, with bodies of the dead and the injured being recovered, covered in dust. The Gaza Ministry of Health also saying that rescue workers were unable in the initial hours to actually get to those buildings to rescue people who were trapped under the rubble. Now, as you said, the Israeli military previously conducted a significant operation at that hospital back in November, where it uncovered what were tunnels beneath the grounds of the hospital, but they were not able to fully prove out their claim that that hospital was being used as a major command and control center for Hamas. But obviously this operation having major implications for the civilian population in northern Gaza, where we know that humanitarian conditions have been spiraling downward quite rapidly. Thousands of civilians were spotted today leaving that area headed for central Gaza, where the Israeli military is also conducting operations over the course of the last week. Julia.
Jeremy Diamond, thank you. Now, Russian President Vladimir Putin has officially secured a fifth term in office, allowing him to stay in power until at least 2030. His win was a foregone conclusion, with most opposition candidates dead, jailed, exiled, or barred from running. China and North Korea congratulated Vladimir Putin on his win, while the U.S. criticized the contest. One White House spokesperson saying it was, quote, neither free nor fair. Matthew Chance reports from Moscow.
As he basks in the glory of a fifth term, President Putin is lashing out at US criticism that his carefully choreographed re-election was neither free nor fair, instead taking a swing at the US political system, suggesting court cases involving Donald Trump were politically motivated.
Can it be considered democratic to use administrative resources to attack one of the candidates for President of the United States? The use of the judicial system, this has become simply ridiculous and a disgrace in front of the whole world.
Officially, the Kremlin says it has no preference who's the next US president. And amid a costly war in Ukraine, Donald Trump's claims he would end the fighting quickly if elected may play into the Kremlin's hands, pressuring Ukraine into a peace deal favoring Moscow. The idea the US and the West should back off military support for Ukraine to prevent escalation is also a theme Putin is pushing after his recent election win.
The conflict between Russia and NATO will be just one step away from a full-scale World War III.
I will prevent, and very easily, World War III, very easily.
That overlapping rhetoric is now fueling concerns among Western officials of a repeat of the damaging Trump-Putin relationship of Trump's first term, in which then-President Trump backed Putin over his own intelligence services on the issue of Russian election interference.
Thank you so much.
More recently, instead of criticizing Putin for the recent death in an Arctic penal colony of Alexei Navalny, Russia's most prominent opposition leader, Trump compared it to his own legal battles. The sudden death of Alexei Navalny has made me more and more aware of what is happening in our country, Trump posted on his Truth Social platform. And this was Putin, after his election win on Sunday night, mentioning Navalny by name for the first time.
As for Mr. Navalny, yes, he passed away. It is always a sad event. And there were other cases when people in prisons passed away. Didn't this happen in the United States?
In a country shocked by the death, and after an election condemned by independent monitors as unfair, it's one comparison with the United States the Kremlin is happy to make. Matthew Chance, CNN Moscow.
Okay, coming up for us, filtering the fakes. YouTube taking measures to ensure AI content is labeled appropriately. Plus, elections, wars, workers' rights and national security risks. The impact on trade? Challenging. The Director General of the WTO discusses falling forecasts and galvanizing growth. That's coming up.
This podcast is supported by Sleep Number. Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores? Sleep Number does that. Only Sleep Number smart beds let you each choose your ideal comfort and support. Your Sleep Number setting. Sleep Number smart beds learn how you sleep and provide personalized insights to help you sleep better. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. Temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent. This week on Chasing Life.
Lately, we have been paying attention to a very different virus, bird flu, which is caused by the H5N1 virus. If you start to hear that it's circulating in pigs, that would be a concern.
That means I would go from sleeping with one eye open to one and a half eyes open. Yeah, that would make me very concerned.
Listen to Chasing Life, wherever you get your podcasts.
And welcome back to First Move, and to all our viewers in the US, UK and Latin America, we hope you're having a wonderful Monday evening. And for all our First Movers across Asia, happy Tuesday. And most importantly, happy first day of spring. And there's a bit of an early spring fever on Wall Street, too, in today's money move. The major averages pushing higher thanks to big tech gains. Google's parent company, Alphabet, rising more than 4% on reports that its Gemini artificial intelligence technology could soon power new features in Apple's iPhones. And NVIDIA shares rising as the company's annual developers conference kicked off in California. The company unveiling brand new artificial intelligence-led chips. And green arrows to start the week across Asia. The Nikkei rising more than 2% ahead of the Japanese central bank's big interest rate decision. That happening in just a few hours' time. The Bank of Japan may finally move on from negative interest rates and hike rates even just a little bit for the first time in 17 years. Wow. Now, speaking of artificial intelligence, critics have long warned that it'll become impossible to tell the difference between what's real and what's not. Well, now the video sharing giant YouTube is rolling out new policies to help inform viewers and be more transparent. The site is now requiring creators to label AI-generated content. Claire Duffy joins me now. Claire, in a world where we have half the world, at least the voting population, heading to the polls this year, this is incredibly timely. My question is, how does it work in practice? And what are the consequences for creators if you don't label content?
Right, Julia. So starting today, when creators go to upload a video in YouTube's Creator Studio, they'll see an option to disclose if that video contains realistic AI-generated content. So that could include images, video, or audio. They'll see a question asking them whether, for example, their video makes it appear as if a real person said or did something that they didn't do. And if creators repeatedly fail to add that required disclosure to realistic-looking AI, they could face consequences, including potentially losing the ability to monetize or make money from their videos. Now, it's worth noting that creators won't be required to identify not realistic AI-generated content. So, for example, if I created a video that shows me on the moon riding a unicorn using AI, that is not going to need a label according to this new YouTube policy. And for users, what they're going to see on their end is now a new AI-generated label that will show up most often in the description of videos, but for potentially sensitive topics like politics, you mentioned the upcoming election, that label will appear more prominently on the actual video player. So YouTube's certainly trying to make an effort here to ensure that users aren't misled or potentially confused by very realistic AI-generated content, which is now so easy to access and create.
Yeah, I'm still stuck on the you on the moon riding a unicorn comment, quite frankly. But the line between that and something that's sort of less obviously completely fake and created is a blurred one, I think. But this is a good effort. We'll see how it goes. Claire Duffy, thank you so much for that. And that image, of course, which is priceless. Okay, let's move on. Tropical cyclone Megan has made landfall in Australia, packing winds of 140 kilometres per hour. Just to give you a sense, that's the equivalent of a Category 1 hurricane in the Atlantic Ocean. Now, parts of the country's northern territory could see more than a month's worth of rain. Chad Myers joins us on this. I mean, that kind of wind speed can blow trees over. It can attack dwellings, clearly. And we must be talking about flood risk, Chad, too.
Sure. And yeah, of course. And that storm surge, all that wind blows that water on land and up onto the shore, kind of that bubble of water that follows a tropical cyclone onshore with it. This thing made landfall 16 hours ago, and it's still like a very, very healthy little center there. I mean, this thing has not fallen apart in any stretch of the imagination. Really, very close to Center Island was the landfall. But a wind gust of 170 kilometers per hour, that was the highest gust. And it is still raining. Look at Center Island, 586 millimeters of rainfall so far in 3 days. That is 24 basic inches of rainfall in 72 hours. And it's still going to rain. Because it isn't really raining itself or dying, we are still going to see 250 to almost 500 millimeters of rain across the northern NT. This is going to be a flood maker, I'm afraid. Down to the south, cold front comes through, makes some rain for you, Melbourne, but this is really not going to be a major event other than about a 10-degree cool down. We'll take that because it has been so ridiculously hot still for this time of year, but how about 17 for Wednesday? That'll feel a lot cooler than the 37 you had last weekend. Sydney, you're down to 21 for the end of this week. Back up to the north here, we'll see a little bit of cooler air come into parts of Japan again, just a couple of degrees. But what you'll notice on this map still, the snow coming across parts of North Korea into Vladivostok and also into the western prefectures here of Japan. It seems like I've been talking about the snow now. The same areas getting snow for months, and it has been months. This is like a lake effect snow event in the U.S., but it is a sea. This is a much bigger area of water than Lake Erie or Lake Ontario or Lake Superior that we have here in the States. 12 degrees, though, in Osaka's temperature is still going to be well above Tokyo's freezing point. So, yes, the snow will be Nagano, where the Olympics were, in those higher elevations, above 2,000 to 3,000 meters. That's where the heaviest snow will be over the next couple of days. We will keep an eye on Megan. This is a really big event here, I think, going to make some significant flooding in places that need the rainfall at times, but you don't need a half a year's worth of rain, a half a year in 3 days. And that's what they got.
You absolutely don't. We'll continue to watch Cyclone Megan. And I'm perfectly comfortable, by the way, talking about skiing in Japan in March, even while we're talking about spring. Perfectly comfortable. Chad Myers, thank you for that. We'll be back after this. Stay with us. Welcome back to First Move and a look at more of the international headlines this hour. The U.S. Supreme Court is once more blocking Texas from enforcing a controversial immigration law. The state law allows officials to arrest and detain people suspected of entering the country illegally, raising fears of racial profiling. This latest hold will remain in place while legal challenges play out. It did not include an expiration date. Iceland is facing its fourth volcanic eruption since December. Barriers have been keeping the country's main airport safe. The eruption is threatening the Blue Lagoon, a very famous tourist hotspot. Tourists there have had to be evacuated multiple times in recent months. And the world's oceans have broken heat records every single day for the last year. Human-caused global warming has been boosted by the recent El Niño phenomenon, which in turn supercharges ocean heat. One specific area of concern, the North Atlantic. Temperatures have been running particularly hot in that area, which is a key spot too for hurricanes. And new pictures have emerged after the Princess of Wales has reported abdominal surgery, reportedly taken over the weekend. I'll describe it for you now. We'll bring those images to you when we get them. Prince William and Princess Kate appear to be leaving a farm shop in Windsor. They're smiling and holding hands. It follows, of course, wild social media speculation about the couple. And this comes after that edited Mother's Day photo, which, of course, caused huge controversy. CNN's royal historian Kate Williams joins us now. Okay, I'll go even further. And these images have first been seen on TMZ or TMZ online. And now, of course, they're blanketed across the internet. Kate looks fit. She's carrying a bag herself. She's sort of bouncing as she's walking. I will note that TMZ also said that they went immediately to the metadata to check this video, to check the authenticity as best they can, which says something else. But it does and is the first time that we've seen her walking or outside of a vehicle since, what, December?
Yes, the last time we saw her, Julia, was at Christmas. We hadn't seen her since. Then she was in hospital in January. And then we were told she wouldn't be out and about till Easter on engagements. And then there was this radio silence from the palace into which all these conspiracy theories rushed. The Mother's Day photo last Sunday was supposed to stop them. It just fueled them. And then there has been a flurry of activity over this weekend, hasn't there? There have been sources saying she might come out on Easter. There have been sources saying she's going to come back to work after the children go back to school on April the 17th, for the Easter holidays. And then there was a reported visit to the Windsor Farm shop. There wasn't any footage initially. And now there is this photo that's taken by the member of the public, and they've checked the stats, as you say, and it was taken on an iPhone and looks completely authentic. So certainly people are going to be thrilled to see Kate looking so well, smiling, carrying a bag up and out after what must have been pretty tough abdominal surgery. It looks like her recovery is going very well. But this has been damaged limitation from the palace, because the strategy so far has not been successful. All these rumours were out there, all these very damaging rumours. And I think, you know, this is their strategy. And what we probably will see in the next couple of weeks is a more formal picture of Kate, perhaps with some thank you cards and a little bit of a statement.
Yeah, I was about to say, I mean, again, if people go on the internet, they can see these pictures because they've now gone wild and they're being retweeted and reshared on social media. We, as a news organization, go through a whole host of checks and balances and approvals before we can share those images with you. So you'll get a sense very soon once we've been through that process. But I think the fact is, Kate, as you've said, the conspiracy theories surrounding Kate have been wild over her health, over the status of her relationship with the Prince of Wales, with William. Obviously exacerbated in the face of that Mother's Day photo, as you described, that was then doctored, and that then set everybody that was sharing those conspiracy theories on social media off again. Do you think this now draws a line under at least some of that, that we've seen her walking, we've seen her looking obviously very healthy, I think, from the videos that I've seen?
Yes, I think this does. Obviously, some of the wilder statements were suggesting she wasn't in the country. They were suggesting that, you know, she was no longer with us. It's very clear that she is in good health. And I think that, you know, she's recovering. She's recovered very well from obviously what was pretty hard surgery. So I think it does draw a line. But I think there is more that the palace needs to do. I think essentially we see a difference here between the Princess of Wales and the King. Now, the King is head of state. We do have to have more updates, but their strategy of doing a few pictures of him with some thank you cards that Camilla said a few things about him, that really worked to make it clear that everyone thought that the King was what he said he was doing, recovering from his cancer. But with Kate, because it was silent, everyone just panicked and the internet went wild. And when William didn't attend the funeral of his godfather, King Constantine of Greece, it just went totally crazy. And what's happened is that Kate herself, I think, was very distressed by all this. She was hoping to have a quiet recovery, and it was all this just very distressing. She felt that, you know, she felt very bad about this whole photo. I don't believe that she did doctor it. I think she took the fall for someone else, but she felt very bad about that. And then, you know, it all made everything worse. So really, I think that this does stop some of it, but they do need to do something a bit more formal than a visit to a Windsor farm shop. They do, I think, need to have a bit more of a formal photograph. But you know, the things have changed. Whatever photograph they put out has got to be very careful. They've got to be very careful that it is totally trustworthy, not a single bit of change, not a single bit of even a red eye, because there is this now distrust there's been after that Mother's Day photo, which just caused total chaos. And as you say, you know, the internet's gone wild for the Kate theories. Even Kim Kardashian said she was looking for her. So this is what the world want to stop. They want to stop this and quell this so they can have the focus on their work and their causes.
Yes. Formal photo, please. Not doctored, to your point, I think, in any way beyond the ordinary enhancements that get done, and it is seen as acceptable, certainly in the industry. Kate, do you think trust has been broken? You pointed out the difference in handling. And of course, King Charles is the head of state, so that's a different perhaps scenario in terms of what it means for the public and his decision to share some details and updates versus the sheer level of privacy surrounding Kate and the lack of information, and then to your point, the bungling of the process of providing some form of information. Do you think lessons have been learned, and perhaps any situation that arises with Kate as one of the most photographed women in the world? The interest is huge. They caught that interest on social media. Perhaps when things do happen, even whether it's health related or otherwise, the handling of this will be different.
I feel so sorry for Kate. I mean, surgery is tough for anyone. It's tough on the body. It can be very tough on the mind. And what she needed was peace and quiet, but she wasn't protected. Kate, as you say, is so photographed, so loved. Everyone was thinking about her. And the internet and all the conspiracy theories rushed into the vacuum. You know, royals always doctor photos. The Christmas photos of the Wales is Louis was missing a finger and there was a sort of foot coming out of nowhere. And no one normally minds, but with everything that had gone on, that photo was seen as really a great problem. The agencies withdrew it. AFP, the very reputable agency, said that Kensington Palace was, they compared them in trust levels of trust to the agencies from Iran and North Korea. Now, that's really a very, you know, very bad comparison. So, you know, there have been problems. There have been a lot of problems with the strategy. No PR official would advise someone to do radio silence like this. They would advise a few little updates like the King had. I think lessons have been learned. I think, above all, this has been very hard for Kate, but it has been because people have been very worried about her. They've been concerned about her. She wasn't there. They're worried about her. But overall, I think that it's William who needs to think very carefully about this strategy. It's William who needs to think forward.
I have to interrupt you. I would keep talking to you for the rest of the show, but I've run out of time. We hope it came from a place of care, but yes, it sort of fell into a vacuum. We wish her well. Kate Williams, thank you for your insight as always. We're back after this.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to First Move. Now, while economists continue to debate the probability of a soft economic landing, much of the outlook for growth is dependent on free and robust global trade. And on that score, the World Trade Organization still sees major challenges ahead, including high inflation, tighter central bank monetary policy, as well as the ongoing conflicts in Ukraine and Gaza, not to mention worsening climate change. I talked to WTO Director General about their falling forecasts, and despite the challenges of finding consensus in a year where half the world is headed to elections, their recent success in helping poorer nations catch up. Take a listen.
I definitely think, Julia, that the risks are to the downside, unfortunately. In fact, we'll have a new forecast, trade forecast, on the 10th of April. But looking at the numbers, the trade barometer we just released on the 8th of March shows a little bit of uptick of activity in the first quarter of this year. But, you know, the risks are all to the downside. So we still feel that the forecast of 3.3% growth for goods trade that we made this year is likely to fall quite far short of that. And it's because of all these tensions that you see. We see in the Red Sea what is happening, the fact that the diversions through the Cape of Good Hope add considerably more time to transport of goods than previously, and more days means more costs. Luckily, the impact has not been as bad, Julia, as one would think, because I think that businesses are managing their supply chains a bit better. They have more inventory. We also have more container ships on the market, so freight costs have not gone up as much as we would expect. We mustn't also forget climate change. You see what's happening in the Panama Canal, the drought. Mm. you know, canal closures at some points, and, you know, ships of a certain size are having difficulty being allowed through.
It's clearly a tough time to make any form of agreement. We've got half the world this year going to elections. We have leaders that are hypervigilant. I think about Labour and particularly pleasing the working public at this moment. It's a tough time for consensus too at the WTO. Having said that, what were you most happy with coming out of the last meeting that was held, a month ago?
You mentioned all the tensions and the conflicts that are now there. You also mentioned the fact that more than 60 countries are going into elections, and of course concerns about domestic constituencies, you know, farmers going on strike in many countries. You also have high inflation, high food prices. So a lot of tension domestically that members have to watch out for. And against that kind of backdrop, I think it's been quite, MC13 was taking place in a difficult time. But that is why I feel quite happy that we had some good successes. We have our dispute settlement system, the only place in the world really where members can bring trade disputes against each other. And that system needs reform. And we were able to make some progress on that reform and to bring it to the 13th ministerial for blessing by the minister, so to speak, to let us know whether we're on the right track. So they did bless some of that work done. We are not there yet by any stretch of the imagination, but we are well on our way. And they confirmed their desire for us to complete the reform process by 2024, that's by the end of this year. We also succeeded in reaching an agreement that 28 of our members, who are the poorest, the least developed countries, have been negotiating with others for 10 years, and that is to give them additional time when they graduate out of least developed country status to benefit from all the concessions that the poorest countries benefit from at the WTO. We were happy to see that closed. I think for developing countries, it was a very good outing.
I sort of see the world in two terms, sort of pre-2024 presidential elections in the United States and after. Reaching some kind of consensus and agreement surely gets more difficult if we have a President Trump in the White House who, for want of a better word, has been pretty rude about the WTO and is threatening now 60% tariffs on China. Does it get more difficult generally, whether it's on the economics or on the agreements at the WTO, in that scenario, in your mind?
Well, Julia, the way I look at it is this. Regardless of who wins the election, I try to focus on the issue of what are the reforms that the WTO needs to do and to accomplish to remain relevant in the 21st century. And I think that's what we should worry about and do the work we need to do anyway.
I think you would agree with me that it does matter in terms of the tone that the world takes on these kind of an agreements. But we'll move swiftly on. Do you think there is a way to accept and adopt a new global consensus, though, on trade that does put more emphasis on the worker, perhaps even puts more emphasis on national security, too? Because we are seeing that all over the world, whether it's the United States, whether it's China and beyond. And these are some of the biggest players in the world. Whether that can be established without bringing back the barriers to trade that, you know, the WTO spent three decades trying to reduce and successfully doing so.
When we talk about labor, each and every agreement we reach, I always think about what does this mean for labor? Yeah. On the issue of national security, yes, we also have to think of ways in which our agreements can be sensitive to issues of national security. Of course, at the WTO, our agreements spell out under what circumstances members can invoke national security concerns. Those are quite clear. But I always insist that countries know their national security concerns best. But invoking those concerns should not mean that they have to be a resort to protectionist measures. Again, I do not see the two as you know, trade-offs with each other. I think you can protect your national security and do so in a manner that does not result in anti-competitive behavior.
75% of world trade today takes place in some form on WTO terms. That's an enormous statistic, and
I'm not quite sure how the world would work without the WTO. What would that look like?
Well, thank you, Julia, for saying that. I think it's something that most people don't realize, that WTO rules govern most 75% of world trade, as you said. That's the rules and the tariff schedules that members have committed to at the WTO. So if you remove that, it would be every country on its own, and people could set whatever tariffs they wanted on each other's goods. And I think that would be quite chaotic. So it's almost like the air you breathe. That's what the people don't notice it. But actually, world trade takes place on WTO terms, and it would be very unruly without it.
Economic oxygen. Thank you to Dr. Ngozi there. Now, coming up for us, a controversy over water bottles. That's the reality for one Chinese firm, and it's weighing on the wealth of China's richest man. The details next. China's richest man under pressure for not being patriotic enough. At the center of the complaint, package design. Zhong Shanshan owns Nongfu Spring, China's largest maker of bottled water. His critics are saying the bottles, featuring temples and eye-grabbing red, are borrowing from Japanese culture. Mark Stewart has more from Beijing.
If you live here in China, there's a good chance you drink Nongfu Spring bottled water. It's the country's biggest maker of bottled water and sold on almost every street corner, including here in Beijing. The company is owned by China's richest man, but his wealth has been shrinking fast in recent weeks, thanks to an unexpected backlash. Zhong Shenshen is facing online attacks, accused of being not patriotic enough, in part because of the designs of some of his product packaging. On the bottles, you can see a temple, you can see a crane. Some Chinese people feel these images are inspired by Japanese culture. Now, that's upsetting to some people because of long-standing animosity between the two countries. Some Chinese people even claim the red bottle cap resembles the shape of the Japanese national flag. CNN has reached out to Nongfu Spring for comment. A perfect storm that has triggered a nationwide boycott, with people uploading videos of themselves pulling Nongfu Spring's water off store shelves, all in the name of patriotism. All of this is proving to be a heavy blow to business. The online campaign has cut into Nongfu's sales as well as its share price, wiping about $3 billion off its market capitalization since the end of February, according to a CNN calculation. But views on the streets are much calmer.
We should have a fair and just attitude. We shouldn't be intensifying conflicts. That serves no good for our own government either.
Maybe it is inspired by Japanese architecture, but it could also be inspired by traditional Chinese architecture. If you look back in history, didn't Japan learn from China too? I think it's wrong to be connecting product design to politics.
As Beijing tries to rally behind the private sector in the midst of an economic slump, many worry this war on bottled water could see the business community's confidence dry up even further. Mark Stewart, CNN, Beijing.
The red top feels harsh. Okay, anyway, finally on First Move, feast your eyes on this. You're looking at a blooming, marvelous evening in Washington, D.C., where cherry blossoms are out for all to see. And it's happening much earlier than usual. The U.S. Capitol has experienced one of its warmest winters on record. Temperatures rose to 80 degrees Fahrenheit. That's nearly 27 degrees Celsius by late January. This year's peak bloom is the second earliest on record. The first, March 15th, 1990. And that just about wraps up the show. Thank you for joining us, and I'll see you tomorrow.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.